We are in Boston at the Sheraton, the headquarters for the Next Frontier of the Brain Forum, imagining the next decade of neuroscience research and development. The organization is One Mind for Research. There was a conversation this morning, a symposium, and one of the participants who talked about the frontiers of social cognition was Larry Young, Timmy, professor at psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. And last time we saw you was at the Salk, I think, some years ago when you delivered a lecture there. And it was also fun to see that in the lobby downstairs you were talking to Tom Insel, because of course a lot of the work that you originally did at Emory was with Tom. Let me see if I can put this into context and have you talk about the frontiers of social cognition and the Vole work by brandishing this Time magazine I picked up as I flew here today. Wow. Or yesterday, Sex, Lies, Arrogance, What Makes Powerful Men Act Like Pigs, or Voles. Let's talk about the voles and why you think there are these male-female differences. And as I look back at some of these early papers of yours that I still have around, the neurobiology of pair bonding and so on, polymorphisms associated with divergent social structure in vole species, social cognition. Set the stage for us, Larry, if you would, please.
Well, in terms of what may be different between men and women, if you look in nature, evolutionarily, males and females have different strategies and have different things are important. So for a female, she can only produce a few offspring herself at a time. So. But as in terms of a male has the opportunity to mate with as many females as possible. So in most species, actually, the males who are most successful at mating with as many females as possible are able to spread their genes to the most numbers of offspring. Whereas a female really doesn't have that opportunity to spread her genes more widely than from her own ovaries. So I think that is sort of the evolutionary antecedent to this sex differences in sexual behavior that we see in males in humans. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of diversity among animals in this kind of behavior and sort of the faithfulness of the sexual relationships. Most species, as I said, 97% or so. There's really no relationship that forms between the male and the female at all. The male is just there to have sex with the female, and then he goes off to find another female. She has her babies. But in a few species, they actually form longer-term relationships where the male and female actually form a bond, and they work together to rear their offspring. And humans are a species where that occurs. We do form relationships that last beyond sex, although sometimes there can be extra relationship sex. But still, we form that kind of relationship.
So what are the elements of the neurobiology of pair bonding then? What has your work shown over there?
Yeah, so we have been studying the neurobiology of pair bonding using a little rodent called the prairie vole. It is one of those 3% of mammals that when they mate, they form a lifelong attachment. They nest together, rear their offspring together. And a series of studies have been done. First, let me tell you what we know in terms of the female side, because I think it has an interesting evolutionary history. There's a molecule called oxytocin that is involved in coordinating birth. So it stimulates uterus contractions during labor. Also, after the baby is born, the nursing, the suckling of the baby on the breast stimulates oxytocin release from the brain to cause milk ejection, so it is involved in nurturing the offspring. But we also know that that same molecule is the molecule that switches the brain of a virgin female into a mother, so that it focuses her attention to her offspring. And in rats, that involves increased motivation to nurture offspring so that they'll actually cross an electrified grid to get access to pups. And in other animals where there's a selective bond between the mother and the baby, that oxytocin, the same molecule that stimulates labor and nursing, stimulates that bond between the mother and the baby. Well, studies in voles have found that that same molecule is responsible for the female bonding with the male partner.
So Other species of voles, though, that your colleague that you worked with as well, Sue Carter, the montane voles have a different strategy. Right.
So voles, the prairie voles are just one kind of vole. There are several different kinds that do not form any kind of social attachments. So the meadow vole and the montane vole are two different species that are not only do they not form social attachments, but they're relatively asocial. They don't particularly like to engage in social contact. So we've been sort of studying the differences between these two species to figure out why is it possible that prairie voles can form bonds, but the meadow voles cannot. And you might think there's differences in oxytocin, but if you look in the brain, the levels of oxytocin are identical. What's different is the location of the receptors for oxytocin. So the receptor is the molecule that allows the cell to respond to oxytocin. And if you look at where they are, you will find that in the animals that can form these bonds, they're highly concentrated in areas like the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in reward, reinforcement, and addiction. So that the same areas that are involved in attachment are involved in addiction. But if you look in the species that can't form the bonds, they don't have those receptors there. So this tells us that diversity in social behavior can can arise from diversity in receptor expression in the brain.
Okay, now I mentioned to you earlier that Pat Churchlin has a book out called Brain Trust at the moment, which we've talked about on the Science Network. Subtitle is What Neuroscience Tells Us About Morality, and she uses the vole work, in fact, to suggest that perhaps there's a neurobiological platform of bonding there that has eventually becomes outside initial kin to kith, and then wider social groups, and eventually evolves into what we now think of as morality. I mean, I've heard you talk about these sorts of things too. I mean, your comments on that?
Yeah, I think it's a sort of reasonable idea that sort of many aspects of social relationships, I think, evolve from that evolutionarily ancient maternal infant bond. That's really the first pro-social behavior, where a mother has her offspring and then her brain needs to be focused on those offspring and she needs to be able to display altruistic behavior, if you will, to protect those offspring, put her own self in danger to protect those offspring. And it's in voles we see that has widened a little bit, so that now the molecule is not only involved in the mother-infant bond, but it's also involved between the bond between partners. In human studies, we see that oxytocin does things like, one is increased trust, also increases empathy towards others. So I think that this molecule, does play a wide variety of roles in regulating interpersonal relationships, empathy, understanding of others. I think it's a very interesting evolutionary story from maternal behavior to society in humans.
Now, what about males? What about talk about vasopressin as well?
Right. So, in males, we do believe that oxytocin plays some role in male bonding to females, but most of the work is actually focused on vasopressin. So, vasopressin is a molecule very similar to oxytocin. It's different only in two amino acids. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's different about it is that it's sexually dimorphic, which means that males have much more of vasopressin than do females in parts of the brain that regulate behavior. It's androgen dependent. Testosterone increases vasopressin expression. So females have very little as a consequence. Males have much more. And if you look at what vasopressin typically does in other species, it stimulates territorial behavior, territorial aggression. Mm-hmm. So in hamsters, for example, they're solitary animals, they scent mark their territory. If you take a hamster, inject it with a vasopressin, it immediately, within less than a minute, starts scent marking everything in its cage. It's a very powerful inducer of territorial behavior. And in voles, now, it seems to be involved in pair bonding as well. And if you think about evolutionary implications of that, as I mentioned before, bonding in the female seems to evolve from the maternal nurturing circuitry, whereas bonding in the male, at least in the voles, seems to have evolved from territorial circuitry. So maybe the male-female bond has elements of territoriality mixed in with it.
I see from the little bio in the program for this, it says that you're very interested in using the knowledge gained from voles to inform novel therapies to enhance social cognition in psychiatric disorders such as autism. And you, just this year, established the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience at Emory, bringing together basic scientists and clinical researchers. How's that going to work? What's the ambition here?
Well, this is something that came about relatively late in my career. You know, in the beginning, I was really interested in evolution, genes, brain behavior relationships, right. These kinds of things, never really taking too seriously the idea that the things that we learn about in these little rodents that run around in the meadow or the prairie has much to do with human behavior. But actually, it turns out that there's some really remarkable parallels between what is involved in prairie vole relationships and in human relationships. And if you think about that clinically, there are disorders such as autism is one that we often think of in terms of where there are disruptions in social relationships and social reciprocity. If we could harness what we understand in the vole brain of the circuitry involved in promoting social relationships, perhaps we could use that to enhance social functioning in autism. So, as I mentioned earlier, intranasal oxytocin in humans has been shown to increase trust, but also increase eye-to-eye contact. So the amount of time an individual looks into the eyes of others, these are in typical adults now, not autistic. It increases empathy. It increases the ability to infer the emotions of others. So you can imagine in a psychiatric condition like autism, where all of these things are in deficit, maybe you could use this molecule to increase the connectedness of those individuals with others. And so I think that potentially, drugs that can manipulate the oxytocin system could be used to enhance social functioning, enhance social cognition, enhance the saliency of social stimuli, and could be then paired with the behavioral therapies that are often very successful in autism to enhance social functioning. So with all that in mind, it was very exciting to be able to establish at Emory the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience. And the idea behind that is really that people like myself who've traditionally used animal models to understand the circuitry of behavior really should be talking to people who are doing, say, trying to understand the social cognition in humans, in typical humans. Why do we cooperate? Why do we have compassion for others, altruism, things like that? But that group of people that are interested in basic neuroscience of social function should really get together with people who are interested in diseases of the social brain. So for example, autism, schizophrenia, where the negative symptoms involve social withdrawal, and that maybe through collaborations, we will be able to actually translate those discoveries that we've made in the voles into treatments. And we were very lucky to recruit at Emory Ami Klin, who is one of the leading researchers in autism research, who is developing diagnosis earlier and earlier in autism. And we hope that collaborations between myself, people at Yerkes Primate Center who work with primates, and Ami's group at the Marcus Autism Center can all get together and really move the field forward and lead to better treatments.
Yeah, I know that your Trends in Neuroscience paper last year was the prairie vole, an emerging model organism for understanding the social brain. So the social brain, this entire meeting, why now? Why do you think now it's been so important to bring all these people together into this kind of moonshot for the mind?
Well, I think it's time. We have really gained a great understanding of sort of the brain function, basic science of how memories are formed, sort of our work on social behavior, things of that nature. But really, translating that into real treatments has been slow in coming. And I think that what it requires is a concerted effort by all those involved. The researchers, the pharmaceutical companies, government, fundraisers or funding agencies, everyone needs to get on board because we are right at the cusp of being able to translate this basic science into real clinical applications. So I think that now is the time, that now the time is right. Over the next 10 years, it provided the resources and the motivation, we can really make a big difference.
Had you any idea when you were a small child growing up that this was this was on the horizon for you? How did you get into science in the first place?
Oh, even as a child,
parents, teachers?
Yeah, even as a child, I was very interested in science. I used to read encyclopedias before there was an internet, and I wanted to be an astronomer at some point, a paleontologist. But I grew up on a farm, so no one in my family was a scientist. But growing up on the farm meant that I spent a lot of time walking through the woods and nature and seeing animals interacting.
Where is this?
This is in South Georgia, Sylvester, Georgia, so-called peanut capital of the world. But growing up on that farm, looking at animals and seeing how they all had certain types of behavior, certain species had certain personalities, if you will. I became fascinated in the idea that there must be some biological mechanism that creates a brain that allows that instructs that brain to create certain kinds of behaviors. You know, why is it that blue jays only want to court other blue jays? How do they know that? You know, and all the different species have their own specific behaviors. So, but it wasn't until after I got into college and I learned about DNA and biochemistry, I was a biochemistry major, sort of got the idea is that maybe we can make the link between biochemistry, genes, and these behaviors. That really, these species-typical behaviors must be encoded by the DNA sequence, the A's, G's, C's, and T's of the genome, which means that variation in that genome must be responsible for variation in behavior. So that's one of the reasons I came to the VOLE system, not necessarily because I wanted to find a treatment for autism, but because I was very intrigued by the idea that you had these two different species that looked nearly identical but behaved very different. And we actually have been able to find gene sequences that differ between the two that may be related to the behavior. So I actually became into this field because I was interested in biochemistry and evolution, but now I see that there's really important implications for translational psychiatry.
So you worked originally with David Cruise?
Yes.
Who did lizard work, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. I actually studied the evolution of sexual behavior in lizards, believe it or not. Some of the lizard species that we studied are, there was a two species, one of which was an all-female species. They lost the males of the species. They reproduced by cloning. Yet even though there were no males, they still engaged in sexual behavior. So the females were engaged in basically so-called lesbian sexual behavior. They would mate with each other because, although there was nothing transferred, it was simply the behavioral stimulation of that sexual, the courting, and that's what would kick off the ovarian cycle. Of course, the other species that were very closely related, looked the same, were regular run-of-the-mill sexual species where you have males and females, and the females did not engage in that behavior. So my first exploration of the biology of sex differences in behavior or in species differences in behavior was actually in lizards. But that training with David Cruise gave me the foundation of sort of understanding psychology of behavior, but also biochemistry of behavior and genetics of behavior. and sort of an overall perspective that really, I think, laid the foundation for my future development, working with the Voles when I began working with Tom Insel.
Tom, of course, as we said, was downstairs, current director of the National Institutes of Mental Health, so it's a sort of interesting connection going on there. If you're now interested in social cognition and expanding the Vole work, you've both gone in that direction. When you've given talks on this sort of thing, do you find that people are somewhat unhappy by the idea that something that they value as much as romance and love could actually be down to the chemistry of addiction, basically?
Yeah, I think some people may be disappointed, but I try to explain to them that even though we know the molecules that are involved, it doesn't mean that we've explained every sequence of events in the brain that leads to something like love. So there's still the mystery is still there. We simply know a few key elements. I happen to believe that emotions like love can be explained ultimately by release of neurotransmitters, release of neuropeptides, acting in specific sorts of the specific sites in the brain, and that can explain our emotions. But we're never going to know enough detail to make it where it's completely understood, where we can write an equation or a chemical reaction to explain love. So I think people shouldn't be too disappointed.
Well, keep on reading your Shakespeare then.
Exactly. As my wife always says, you know, oxytocin, it's interesting, but it's never going to work as well as some flowers. So even though understanding the biology, it doesn't really help in the real life relationships.
What are you working on in the lab right now, exactly? I mean,
We have a few different things going on. One is that I'm very excited about is the Prairie Vole Genome Project. We're sequencing the genome. This should be sequenced at the Broad Institute. Should be finished by the end of the year. So that will allow us to have the entire genome sequence at our exposure. And so one of my main sort of goals is in making the Prairie Vole a model organism, like mice, rats, C. elegans, Drosophila, yeah. And of course an important thing to have for a model organism is a genome, so we're going to have that. We've been doing transcriptomics, looking at changes in gene expression in individual brain regions over the course of pair bond formation. This is incredible technology where you can sequence the mRNAs for tens of millions of molecules in a particular sample. You can actually count the mRNAs from each transcript in different brain regions over the course of pair bond formation. And I think that this will provide a tremendous amount of information about what genes are involved. We've also been able to make transgenic voles, so we're trying to develop transgenic technology so that the voles can be as genetically tractable as mice. Another area that I'm really excited about is related to the Center for Translational Social Neuroscience, and that is taking what we know in voles and applying it to non-human primates. So the idea is to create a pipeline from voles where we can have relatively high throughput screening of drugs, for example, that can stimulate pair bonding. Take those drugs that seem to be most interesting and then test them in primates. Of course, primates are not monogamous, or at least the rhesus macaques that we use are not monogamous. They don't form bonds. But we can look at social cognition, how well they can recognize emotion, faces, and things like that. And we can test whether drugs that can stimulate pair bond in voles can also stimulate social cognition in these non-human primates. And then those would be our best candidates to go in humans. So let me just tell you a little bit about the approach that we're taking for these new drugs, because we're going at it in a very defined way. So as I mentioned, intranasal oxytocin increases trust, ability to infer the emotions of others, empathy, and has even been able been found to increase some aspects of social cognition in autistic subjects. So in actual autistic subjects, intranasal oxytocin has been shown to have some effect on social cognition. But the effects are, I think, limited compared to what they could be. The real potential is not has not been seen, because intranasal oxytocin has limited penetration into the brain. There's a blood-brain barrier, so most of it is actually kept out of the brain, even with the intranasal delivery. Some of it gets in, but then there's has to diffuse to deep regions of the brain, and there's degradation along the way. So I think that what we see in the intranasal oxytocin is really only a small part of the potential. So the approach that we've been taking is trying to identify drugs that can actually stimulate the body's own oxytocin release. Looking for molecules that are on oxytocin neurons, looking for receptors that are on oxytocin neurons that might be targets for drugs. So imagine if we had an oxytocin neuron with known receptors on it, and we could deliver a drug that would activate those receptors to dump oxytocin into the brain. That would have a much more profound effect on social cognition. And in terms of autism therapy, we're thinking that if you could find such a drug that would dump oxytocin and deliver this drug just before behavioral cognitive therapies, you might greatly increase the benefit of those therapies. And we've identified one such drug, or one such receptor that's on the oxytocin neurons, and that's called the melanocortin 4 receptor. So agonists for that appear to stimulate oxytocin release. So this is the sort of avenue that we're going, identifying receptors on oxytocin neurons that might be able to stimulate oxytocin release, testing those on voles, and we find that those agonists stimulate a pair bond in voles even more strongly than injections of oxytocin. Those drugs that work in voles to stimulate the bond, we can test in primates to see if they increase their social cognitive function. And then we can choose those candidates that would be most appropriate to go into humans to increase social cognitive function in autism and perhaps schizophrenia.
Just thinking, pondering the other end of the spectrum, though, in terms of, because in the voles, you find different concentrations of vasopressin receptors, right?
Right.
So you have individual differences in levels of social attachment, bonding, and so on. Going back to my Time magazine piece here, Men Behaving Badly. What it is about power that makes men crazy, the misconduct matrix, not all affairs are created equal, and so on and so forth. Is it too much of a leap to suggest that possibly there are different levels of vasopressin being expressed here by these various characters? I mean, what's the relationship between power and territoriality and vasopressin and the cover of Time magazine?
Well, of course, we don't know the exact link in humans, but in animals, winning a challenge often increases testosterone.
Right.
And that testosterone stimulates vasopressin release. But actually, there's another interesting parallel that I'd like to talk to you about. Where what we find in voles seems to apply to humans as well, and that is with the vasopressin receptor gene.
Okay.
So, as you mentioned, there's individual variation in receptor expression, not only across species like the prairies and the meadow voles, but if you look at within prairie voles, there's quite a bit of individual variation in how much receptors are in particular brain regions. And we identified a polymorphism in the vasopressin receptor, which is a highly repetitive DNA sequence we call a microsatellite, that most people think is irrelevant, just junk DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that variation in this microsatellite seems to predict expression in the brain of voles. So we can actually genotype a vole, and in our laboratory, if the vole has a long microsatellite, that vole is more likely to form an attachment with a female partner. So we can predict behavior by looking at DNA sequence. Well, humans also have vasopressin receptors. Humans also have microsatellites in the vasopressin receptor. Mm-hmm. And there's variation in the length of that microsatellite. And a group in Israel has actually looked at whether that variation in that length reflects expression in the brain of humans. And they found something very similar to what we found, that individuals with longer microsatellites have more vasopressin receptor in their brain, humans. Then another study actually said, well, what does this have any impact on relationship quality, pair bonding? And so they looked at 1,000 individuals that were in live-in relationships and asked them a series of questions about their relationship. And they found that for females, it didn't matter. The vasopressin receptor polymorphism had no impact on their relationship quality, as it would not in voles. They found that for the males, individuals with a certain polymorphism that were homozygous for one of those alleles were twice as likely to report a crisis in their marriage in the last year. And they were also twice as likely not to be married. They were simply shacking up with their partner. They didn't want to make that extra commitment. And also the spouses or the partners of those males reported more dissatisfaction in the relationship. So here's an example of where we can find a polymorphism in a gene that predicts social attachment behavior in voles. And the evidence is that that same gene can predict some amount of variation in social relationship quality in humans. So I think that that's really quite fascinating. I don't get carried away and think that all of our behavior is determined by genes. Only a small portion of human variation, I'm sure, is determined by this particular gene.
No, but I can imagine some personal genomics companies suggesting that it would be wise for women to have these polymorphisms in their potential spouse's DNA.
You can do that. There are companies that will genotype the vasopressin receptor. But I'd like to say that I do not promote that at all. I don't think it's a good idea, because the variation in the gene only explains a small fraction of the variation. Statistically significant, but a small fraction. So if you find a person, let's say a woman finds a male potential partner, and then she makes a decision based on this little bit of information, she may be missing out on her real life partner.
Yeah.
So I don't advocate people going out and putting too much credence in this kind of gene.
Well, again, the complexity of, the topics that are being discussed here, for example, in some sense, the panel on genetics, genetics is almost simple compared to the complexities of the 3 pounds of wonders issue up here and trying to figure out social cognition. So that's a major challenge.
But genetics is also very complicated. I mean, you can do gene-wide association studies and find certain genes that may correlate with behavior. Other studies often do not replicate those. It takes large numbers of humans in these gene-wide association studies to find relationships. But there are a number of cases where single genes have been found to have profound effects on behavior. But you're absolutely right. The connectome, we saw a talk about the connectome, and the complexity in the numbers of synapses within 1 square millimeter of human brain tissue is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
So if you multiply that complexity, which I'm sure is influenced by all of our experiences, as well as the complexity of the genome, the amount of biological complexity is just mind-boggling. And the fact that we can make any way in understanding biology of these things like social behavior, to me, is just fascinating and very exciting.
Do you imagine involving philosophers and ethicists in this as well? I mean, Carl Dicerov on his HHMI page when he talks about optogenetics and finding pathways for anxiety and so on, specifically says that he thinks that this is a time when he needs to talk to some philosophers as well and ethics folks and about some of the implications of this. I mean, I would have thought your center there. Do you have plans to?
Right. We have a center at Emory run by Paul Wolpe, the Center of Ethics at Emory.
Right.
So my center is actually partnered with him, and we are having ongoing discussions about, you know, sort of the ethical implications for intranasal oxytocin, because, you know, there are really now dozens and dozens of investigators out there using intranasal oxytocin, and some of them actually suggest that they, you know, if oxytocin increases trust and maybe increases in-group bonding, more so than out-group empathy, then maybe it could be used, say, by the military. I mean, wouldn't it be advantageous to have your soldiers treated with oxytocin so that they would bond with their group, but not with out-group? Department stores could spray compounds that release oxytocin, you know, through their air system, and somehow have people trust them more and maybe buy more.
Yes.
You know, there really are some important ethical considerations that that we need to discuss. Mm. And also, you know, how could these be used by someone trying to gain the trust of another person, or maybe have that person bond with them? I mean, could something that stimulates oxytocin release be misused in a singles bar to increase one's likelihood of getting a date? You know, all of these kinds of things are important considerations.
We actually did some filming at the Society for Neuroethics, and on the TSN's homepage, I think you can still find Paul Wolpe, this conversation there. Also Paul Zak. Dr. Love, of course, who uses the oxytocin. You've been through had some great experiences as you're going through your own training. You've got a lab, you've got students, so on. Peter Medawar's book, Advice to a Young Scientist. What have you learned? What advice would you give to a young scientist now?
Don't give up. I mean, as I was a young scientist, I wasn't sure that I would be able to come up with the ideas that would allow me to continue to get funding and that people would be interested in. I wasn't sure that I would be able to get tenure. I had all those anxieties that all young scientists have. But I continued to pursue my passion and never gave up, continued trying, and just continued to do exactly the things that I was most excited about. And that has paid off every step of the way. I've made it all the way through to full professor, and now facing the challenge of creating a center to bring multiple labs together to think in a common direction. It just continues to get exciting. There's new challenges along the way. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think the science is one of the best careers possible, because you get to sort of, you know, do the things that you really are excited about and passionate about, and if you're successful, you can actually make a big difference.
What do you think of the relationship between science and society? And I put this in the context of a question I ask all of the people I have conversations with. Remind them that the president, when he came into office, said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. What is the rightful place of science in society?
Well, I think as scientists, one of the things that we really have to work towards is being able to explain to the public and make the public excited and understand the potential of science. So science, one of the places of science is new discoveries to treat these terrible disorders, all kinds of medical disorders, including psychiatric disorders. But also I think it's really important to get young people excited about the basic fundamental questions of science, like I was. In the beginning, I was not interested in treating a disease. I was just fascinated by how the brain works. And I think that that kind of excitement is something that we need to instill in our young kids so that those who have the potential to make great discoveries actually are excited about the science and not diverted to other career paths. So I think that there's a lot of hidden potential in our society that we need to make sure that there's a pathway for them to develop.
Did you ever consider another career path? Ever something you would have wanted to have done other than science?
Well, early on, I considered being a physician, but I quickly realized that actually I was so fascinated by what was not known, rather than how to use what is known. That I felt that my life would be more exciting, invigorating, if I could make new discoveries that no one else had ever discovered. But actually, I don't think that I ever wavered from science, except for a little period from the age around 15 to 18, when I was actually more interested in girls and maybe staying around my hometown and being a farmer and those kinds of things. But as soon as I developed past that stage, then I refocused back onto science.
Okay. If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your dinner table anybody, do you have any heroes, any people from history that you'd like to have a conversation with, ask a question of?
Well, I think there's a lot of people to choose from. I guess one person that who has made a tremendous impact in all of biology, of course, is Charles Darwin. And he's inspiring by the amount of effort and time that he put into sort of understanding the biology, the basic science of biological function. And I guess the roots of my interest in biology really come from evolution, I think it would be really exciting to be able to talk to him about how he was able to make the changes that he did in the society and the culture that he was in at the time.
I think he'd be really interested to hear about genomics as well and prairie vole genomes and so on. I think he'd probably have a fun conversation.
Yes, he'd probably be very excited, I think, about the things that we discovered about how exactly the mechanisms by which behavior changes. He studied how phenotypes change, but now we actually have the ability to see the genes, see the changes in DNA sequence that can give rise to differences in behavior. I mean, we're doing experiments in the laboratory that basically recreate what we think happened evolutionarily. Just to give you a couple of examples of that, I mentioned that metal voles they're asocial, they can't form bonds, and they have very low densities of receptors in certain parts of the brain, vasopressin receptors. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that maybe evolutionarily there were changes in the genome that rearranged the receptor distribution, that changed the way the animals behaved, and then that changed their success in nature, increased their adaptive fitness, and they had more offspring that would survive. Well, we can recreate that evolutionary event by taking a viral vector that's got the prairie vole vasopressin receptor gene, inject that into the metal vole brain to cause the metal vole to express the receptor like the prairie vole. So recreating that evolutionary event to change receptor distribution. And we find that those male metal voles now with a prairie vole pattern of receptors display the social behavior of a prairie vole. They can form attachments. So there's one example of how we can sort of recreate evolutionary events. Another example is actually by the microsatellite that I mentioned, where we can change the length of the microsatellite predicts behavior. We can actually take that gene with varying lengths of microsatellite and put those into mice so that we can study precisely making knock-in mice, replacing the mouse vasopressin receptor with pyrivole vasopressin receptor with varying lengths of microsatellites to see how that affects expression. And we know that it does. And to see how that affects behavior. So in a very precise way, much more precise than Charles Darwin would have ever even imagined, we can sort of see exactly how evolution occurs at the level of DNA.
So what are you finding in the mice? What are the results showing?
Well, the results are showing that the subtle variations in the microsatellite length, you know, can affect how the receptors are expressed in the brain. We know that in mice, if we make the mouse have a pyrivole pattern of receptor, they show increased social behavior. So right now we're trying to define, I can't tell you the exact results yet, but we are defining exactly how the length of that microsatellite affects not only expression in the brain, but in behavior.
Okay. So, final question, because this is really interesting. But what are you optimistic about?
I'm really optimistic that, at least in my own field of social neuroscience, that we are going to be able to gain a much better understanding of the biochemistry of social interactions. I mean, just a dozen years or so, I think it would have, most people would have thought that complex social behaviors is beyond the realm of science. We're never going to understand exactly, you know, why are we motivated to interact with others? How do we form these relationships? What brain regions? But now I think that we can see that we are able to learn quite a bit. We've already learned quite a bit. And with the future of brain imaging, where we can actually image individuals who are cooperating, who are engaging in moral decisions, who are actually interacting, whether you can image the brain while they are both simultaneously, combining that kind of work with the work in our animal models, I think that we are not only going to sort of gain tremendous insights into why we interact with each other, how do we interact with each other, but also why is there individual variation? Why do we differ? Why are some people very socially engaging, politicians, for example, whereas others, like Einstein, maybe was less socially engaging? And then where does that variation come from? How does that fit in with disease states where you have extremes of variation? And then how can we actually treat those individuals with severe disruptions in social behavior? I really believe that we're going to be making progress in that in the next 10 years.
Great. Great to talk to you. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.